Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Sans Pants Radio, Australia's most American podcast network.
Hey everyone, welcome to Bookish. I'm George DeMorales. This is a show where we ask you what's your story and what does it say about you. Today on the show, we have a professor of law at Deakin University. She's done a PhD from University of Melbourne with a focus in property and land law. Seems like climate is a main interest as well as the impact on Indigenous communities. So let's welcome to the show, Samantha Hepburn. How are you, Samantha?
Very well.
I should say Dr. Samantha Hepburn. Sorry, that's my...
That's is fine, actually.
I already said you've got a PhD, then, but you can tell I was reading the bio and skip that, yes. But how are you?
Very well, very well.
Thank you very much for being on the show. I'm very excited. I haven't had someone with a focus in law before, so I might have a bunch of dumb questions.
Please ask. No question is dumb. I always say that to my students, you know, because often you just, particularly in lockdown, you just get complete silence. And so it's good to get questions because at least you know where everyone's coming from.
That's true, actually. Yeah, because I guess in lockdown, like if you're doing it online, you can't even like do the whole like stare at the person so they feel pressured to say something. They can just half ignore the whole thing. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, all of those kind of, you know, human interactions are gone really, and sometimes you freeze in weird positions. So,
oh, really?
Do you have someone online? But. Yeah, it's been a sort of, I suppose, quite steep learning curve teaching online.
Yeah, I could imagine. I know. Don't know if it's going to be going anywhere much anytime soon.
No, that's right. So unpredictable.
Yeah. Yes, you've got interest in energy, but it seems like you were trying to toss up between three books, but you've got one that you've picked as your favorite. So let's kind of start there and then we'll kind of go out into everything else as we go. So your book of choice for today?
Is Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Things. That's the one that I've chosen. But it was a bit of a tricky one because, you know, I really, really loved the Overstory by Richard Powers as well. But anyway, that finally came up. And I also loved the other one that I chose, which was the Christopher Stone's essay on Should Trees Have Standing? Which is such a beautiful piece written in 1972. But anyway, all of that.
Oh, wow. Written back then.
I did, yeah, way back then. And I was sort of going to start with that, but then I just thought, look, actually, I think from a human point of view, and human points of view are really important right now because, you know, we're all in lockdown. We all really need each other. And, you know, we've got a global pandemic going on. I really love some of the ideas that Roy explores. Obviously she's looking at the capacity for humans to hurt each other and to set up these, you know, hierarchies that mean nothing really, mean nothing from the point of view of innocence. And, you know, if we could deconstruct some of that, a lot of the problems might be removed because we're seeing that we have to do that during COVID anyway, you know, trying to reach out to people a little bit more and removing preconceived ideas and you know, being more human to each other. So it's a very, very beautiful book. It's a very sad book. It's looking at the caste system and the love laws in India and the treatment of a low caste servant who was very kind to two young girls, and really his ultimately what happens to him pervades their whole life, you know. And I think it's kind of got reflections for how we've treated Indigenous people, definitely, and the, you know, how that kind of reverberates through generations.
So I guess to because it's funny, I haven't read The God of Small Things, but and the descriptions online seem to be rather vague, so I can't do more than give a vague, very brief description. But it sounds like, yeah, essentially a focus on these kids, their friendship, and then the impact of these love laws, which you might have to explain to me what exactly that is, but how it impacts them within the community. Is that a fair enough?
That's exactly brief, right. Very brief. So your family and, I mean, the love laws are basically you know, you can't marry intercaste.
Okay.
I'm certainly not an expert on this, but there are all these strong rules about what you can and can't do in terms of your interactions with people, and these are, you know, well established. But the horror of it in terms of seen through the eyes of young children, you know, who don't understand any of that. And just look at it as being a person that was kind and nice to them, and you know, couldn't really appreciate the impact that those kind of really well established social constructions have. And how could we make some parallels? And I mean, there are sort of just generally just that general feeling of brutality and racism and discrimination, and I mean, it's been endemic in Australian law. You know, since colonisation, because well, we know that the land framework, the inherited land framework, is a framework which assumes that nobody existed, that when we came, nobody existed, and even if there was somebody that existed, they were so barbarous in their culture that they didn't deserve to have legal recognition. So most of the early cases, land law cases in Australian history, don't even talk about Indigenous people. So they don't even give Indigenous people the dignity of identity. And I suppose that sort of indignity and lack of respect is something that pervades the God of Small Things as well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's because when you mentioned the Indigenous communities, it just from my, again, very brief reading, it didn't seem to directly reflect that, but you're saying just in terms of almost artificial laws creating these issues outlooks on people.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess I want to understand a bit more about that, because that's something which this might be going philosophical with law. How much a law will mold what people think and how much it is just a reflection of what people think. So
it's so interesting because, you know, you just talk about artificially created laws. I mean, laws are supposed to reflect the type of society in which we live. And so in that sense, they're supposed to be dynamic and evolve as we evolve. But obviously that doesn't happen. You know, many laws are outdated and archaic. And indeed, if we look at Terra Nullius and the land laws that we inherited, they didn't reflect Australian culture because or Australian society, because we never had a feudal framework. We didn't have the sort of estate-based system that existed in England for generations. We had a new world, you know, with Indigenous people living here and, you know, vast tracts of land, much of it at that time, you know, really harsh and, you know, scrub-like and difficult. And so what really we needed to do was to develop a more intuitive Australia-based land system, but we didn't do that. We just tried to adapt a feudal system and a feudal mentality to a land system that and a fit so to a physical framework that you know, basically really didn't, I suppose, it never really worked effectively, and then we tried to justify that by saying, oh well, you know, under British imperial law, nobody lives here, nobody exists, these people shouldn't be treated as people, and so therefore we can theoretically kind of utilise these feudal laws and apply them. And that we're still dealing with the fallout from that. I mean, feudal, if you can believe it, we still have a feudal system in Australia. So fictionally, if you own a property, fictionally, the Crown is still the ultimate owner. And so you know, go figure.
As in, like, there's a little part of the Constitution or something which says that.
Well, that's our land system, George, and so what that means is there's a couple of implications for that. First of all, that means that up until recently, if you died intestate, your land would go to the Crown because it always belonged to the Crown, for example. and also, of course, means that the Crown can compulsorily acquire your land. But the other thing it means for Indigenous people is that they obviously never had any relationship with our Crown. And so any interest so native title, which is the sort of creation in 1992, has really kind of existed as this kind of weird subset of property law that's outside the mainframe, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, so again, I may be showing my utter naivety with these things, but native law is that native title is that for the areas which were just gifted back, but I guess
native title was the type of property interest that was recognized by Mabo, and basically what it says is, and here's the kicker, right? First of all, to get native title, there had to be no property right granted over the area. So in 1992, you can imagine that many of the good areas obviously had property rights already granted to them. So no native title. So really you were talking about internal areas that were quite arid and perhaps non-inhabitable in many ways. What was left. Then in order to establish native title, because there are all these strict requirements, Indigenous people had to prove that they had a continuing connection with the land. So it's sort of like colonial formaldehyde, right? You had to prove that what you did at colonisation you're still doing to present day. Otherwise, you don't have this connection. So if you don't have a connection, you can't get this title. It's very difficult to establish native title.
And I've got so many questions already. We've already veered wildly from the book, but that's okay because we can come back to it.
You don't want to do property law.
Well, it's the kind of thing where I just find some of this because the details of it, it's always interesting. Like you, and it does tie back to the book in terms of these artificial constructs and how much that reflects natural human conditions rather than like whatever. So I guess a few things. Like, firstly, to go take a step back, when you mentioned terra nullius, as in that's how Australia was treated as this empty land, are you saying that like when, like Australia was strings spined, is when England colonized America, was there a different legal framework for how they treated that, or was that just before that?
Love that, because I have looked at that contrast. So that they in America basically also inherited the feudal system, but Thomas mm-hmm. Jefferson abolished it, you know. So and then they adopted what's called sort of technically as allodialism. And what that basically means is that if you own land, you're the ultimate owner. There's no overlord or no crown above you. You own it all. So
it's interesting how that treats, like, as in how that's reflected in the culture, isn't it?
Yeah, very interesting. And exactly, and then the sort of legal framework reflects that, because you've got kind of a different texture, really, because you've got bills of rights and, you know, strong constitutional provisions and amendments protecting, you know, property rights. And also you've got, it's very interesting in terms of the energy framework, because resources that reside in the ground for private landowners in America can be exploited, I mean, subject to some exceptions, and I'm being a bit general here, but can be exploited by landowners, whereas in Australia, I'll tell you where this plays out with coal seam gas. If you've got gas under your land, and let's say you're in a New South Wales hotspot, you don't own it, okay? So you have no control over what the state or the crown in right of the state does to exploit that resource. Which this has been the big issue. Lock the gate. Stop them from coming in. But you can't, because you don't own it. You own the land, but not the resource in the land, because the feudal system allows the crown to take that resource away from you.
Oh, that's just so interesting. Like, as in just in terms of, because I do find it's a topic that I find so massively fascinating, is the impact of history on us today, like the long tentacles of culture and how that impacts us.
That's such a good expression, the long tentacles of culture, because that's exactly what happens with property. I mean, property is very old. I mean, a lot of it, you know, is derived from, you know, Roman principles and Greek principles and assumptions about how we should set up society. And then they've sort of been ingrained into sort of historical ways in which civilizations have been ordered. And so feudalism itself is this, you know, bizarre framework, really, this idea that you have, you know, one person as the ultimate, you know, controller of all the land. And that really reflected a time frame when, you know, there were far fewer people and didn't have the industrialized societies that we have, and certainly didn't have the sort of, let's call it, in some ways, ethical progression that we have today. And so the idea that we've still got it is just bizarre.
I mean, the people who it benefits are the ones who make the laws, I guess. So
yeah, and it's very difficult to get rid of it, right? Because if you wanted to,
especially when it's so broad,
Republican debate, you want to get rid of it, you'd have to effectively say, right, okay, Crown has no interest in land anymore, and that would be difficult.
I just go, just be a lot, just a lot of admin.
It's a lot of admin. That's right.
So much admin. okay, so along the same lines, I guess, and this it's just because you're providing an insight, a perspective which I just don't have at all. Because I mean, you're saying all this about how it's reflected in like these old attitudes and how they've maintained till now, but like, I mean, yes, that is obviously the case, but at the same time, is there another way that it could be structured and still be a society where people own things and stuff? You know what I mean?
Yes. That's what academics do. Like, we've still got some utility. I realize that, you know, in a COVID framework where we have no international law students, international students, we're, you know, we're being reduced in numbers and so on. But the whole idea is that we come up with ideas and we kind of research them and workshop them and think about, you know, alternative perspectives. And in a legal sense, what are the options for us? Plenty, plenty. I mean, first of all, I really don't think that there's any need to have a feudal system anymore, particularly because it effectively means that estates that are derived from the Crown are up here and estates that are not, like native title, are way down here. So there's not parity in treatment, and that's unfair. Okay, start with that. Secondly, I think that as we move towards a new future in terms of hopefully, well, our absolute imperative is to stay within 2 degrees. And to stay within 2 degrees
For climate change, you mean?
Yes, sorry, climate change.
I'm
shifting issues now, but it's still a land-based issue. We need to make sure that the way in which we generate energy is sustainable. And, you know, to date, the feudal system has kind of contributed to the problem because the Crown has control of the fossil fuels, right, because they can take them back because they have ultimate ownership, right? I don't want to get too complex here. But what that's meant is, of course, that they're keeping on. I mean, there's a gas-led recovery, George. That's how we're going to get through COVID, apparently. And that doesn't seem consistent with the fact that the International Energy Agency said that we can't have any more fossil fuel projects, you know, if we want to stay within 2 degrees. We can't open up any more fossil fuel. And so I'm wondering whether changing the mainframe, i.e. changing the operators, who controls these resources, would help in terms of basically massively decelerating fossil fuel generation.
Is that a case where there's evidence of this in certain countries? Where that's the kind of thing?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, obviously I'm talking about Australia because Australia has a feudal system. But even in civil codes, you know, I could say that I think there's a little bit more progression there, but still it's all about who controls the resource titles you know, who gives basically the green light to companies to go ahead and exploit. And, you know, my concern is that this isn't necessarily going to stop. It's highly politicized, and, you know, it's all very well for the International Energy Agency to say, oh, well, we don't want any more fossil fuel projects. But what invariably happens is that, you know, the government says, oh, we need this for energy security. Oh, my God, the lights will turn out. You won't have any energy and you won't have any jobs. But, of course, you're not going to have any jobs or energy if we hit 3 degrees. Mm. And so, you know, there is no effective means of I think controlling that political rhetoric. We're seeing a little bit with respect to climate litigation. So you probably maybe read about the Sharma case where the Queensland Federal Court basically said, yep, you have a duty of care towards you, Minister, who are issuing these resource titles, have a duty of care towards young children because you are destroying their future. So that was very recent.
Okay, that does sound like a bold
precedent. Yeah, it was very bold because it's a duty of care. I mean, I don't want to get you too – you're getting totally immersed in law now, George. But
I know, this is a
duty of
dive.
Care is really – it's a high level of responsibility from a legal point of view. And so that was a very positive outcome. Our politicians and our regulators aren't really doing much. And, in fact, it's exacerbating the problem by, progressing fossil fuel when there is clearly other alternatives.
Right. And, this is what I'm trying to, go through in my head. And it might actually tie into the story even. Let me try on this roundabout way to tie it together. Considering I only was able to get a very brief overview of the show. But when you talk about, artificial constructs and how these laws can impact groups of people and it's not – it's separate to what the people are. It's like artificial, as you say. But one thing I always think is interesting about the law, what it seems like, especially if you look at something like America and how its Supreme Court changes things, but obviously that's the case in a lot of places, just they're the most well-publicized, is how much the law ultimately isn't it's like people are living off it and doing it. It's just it's serving the interests of certain people and they can make it say whatever they want almost.
Totally.
So, so that's a part where I'm like, does it matter that much that it's a feudal system or is it literally nothing to do with the actual issue, which is that the people who are looking at it can still make it. So even in the most utopian version of law, you still got the same issues essentially.
Yeah. No, you're right. They're very good points. And I almost don't know how to solve that, but I would say that it does matter. It does matter, even though the same problems could evolve, whatever framework we have. The framework we've got is so out of touch. And property is a very valuable asset. And by property, I'm talking about land and resources. You know, there's only a limited amount of it. We know that, population is increasing. And as climate change accelerates, it'll be difficult for people to live in certain areas. So property is going to become more and more valuable and resources in the ground can't be burned anymore to generate. They can't. And so who has control of that is very important right now because we still have – there's still the slight hope that we could stay within 2 degrees. And to do that, the people that do have control of that have to be pretty much stopped,
Yeah.
It is very frustrating because you end up thinking, what's the point? I can't do anything. I feel cynical. But I always say to my students, it's war. You don't give up. You keep going. And whatever you can do, it might only be a small thing.
It's a firebrand lecture.
But it actually is. I think every day I think, oh, you are kidding me, right? One example, I just recently today was looking at the in Western Australia, they've got a big Gorgon gas project. And the reason they got the title, the resource title and the approval from the environmental for the environmental approvals is that they were supposed to be taking the carbon, liquefying it and putting it underground so they weren't emitting it, And they were supposed to be doing that from 80% of the gas. And it turns out for the last 5 years, they haven't been doing – hardly any of that has been going on. And every year Chevron keeps saying, actually – Chevron being the biggest contributor to greenhouse gas emissions I think that there was a study that came out that said 20 companies produced the most greenhouse gas emissions since 1894, and Chevron's one of the biggest. And they keep saying, we've got design and integrity issues. We have to make sure that it works. And the problem is every time we give a dispensation, that's another year when emissions have gone out, they haven't gone under, that's they haven't been sequestered, and we are making things worse. And so, and if they think they can get away with it, I just feel like that's what's happening.
And I mean, it's a classic, right? If you can, this again goes into like, yeah, the flexibility of these artificial constructs, because like they can just delay, and delay just helps them.
Yeah, it does. And there are communication, knowledge, information, it's all really important. You know, I always say, think, well, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. I try, you know, I really do try, but I don't know how effective it is sometimes. However, I feel like the most effective thing is that, you know, those, the next generation that takes over might have a much greater understanding of what's going on, and it might be too late or it might not.
Well, that's it. I'm glad the show's going to, the episode's going to keep going, because that would have been a grim place to finish if we were finishing there.
Okay, sorry. Well, look, I mean.
No, it's like the urgency, I think, is real. And the issue is that younger people now are aware of the issue. But the problem is that old people aren't dying anytime soon.
Exactly. So, I know.
Like, you're not going to see this change happen.
That's it in a nutshell. And, you know, one thing we can say, well, the universe works in mysterious ways. The one thing about COVID is that global emissions have dramatically reduced, because we haven't had air travel and, you know, people are locked down and they haven't been able to do what they've been used to doing. And that's been very beneficial for the environment in many areas. Obviously not for us. Well, not, you know, in terms of, we wouldn't have wished a global pandemic for that to have occurred. But it's very interesting to make parallels and to say, well, you know, how come we can respond in some ways so rapidly to the profound dangers associated with a global pandemic, but we can't do it for climate change? Because it's this kind of, we keep thinking, oh, it's this distant threat, you know, it hasn't hit us yet.
I think if there's one thing the pandemic has definitely taught everyone, it's that we never had a hope with climate change of getting half the people to believe it, considering half of them don't even believe that COVID's real.
Yeah, exactly.
You never had a hope. Like, what were you thinking? That any of these
That's right. When you think, oh my gosh, there's all these people out there who don't think COVID's real. How on the earth are we going to get them to think that climate change is real? And in fact, I was reading the other day that you know, people were going into hospital terribly ill with COVID, still not believing that it was real. And that's very interesting for lawyers who are, you know, evidence-based, I suppose. Just thinking, wow. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. What hope have we got for the many that think that climate change isn't happening and isn't real?
Yeah, I think it's just the classic. You don't need everyone on board. So that's just, you just got to accept that not everyone's going to ever believe it. So,
yeah.
And move on from there. But so I guess we should go back to the book a little bit.
Yeah, let's
go to the book. Even though I do want to talk even more about this. But but just quickly to give some grounding, because this is still bookish, so we've got to be talking about the book. So with this book, because you've chosen this in reflection of the other, and it does seem like some of the others might be more in line with what you're kind of interested in right now. But in this book, when did you first read it?
I read it many years ago. And in fact, before I did my PhD, and I don't actually remember when it was published, but it was a long time ago. And I think it won the Booker Prize, so, you know, had all these awards. And I remember thinking, oh, this would be, you know how some books you read and you think, I know this is really good for me to read this, but I don't know that I can get past the first 5 pages. You know, I have to really push myself. And I'm reading.
Yeah, yeah.
Reading.
High art.
High art, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's like, ugh. You
know, I remember thinking, oh, I hope this isn't one of those books, and it isn't. Like, you're straight into it, you know, right from the beginning. And I think a lot of that is because it's through the eyes of these twin children that it's kind of a beautiful world that they see, and that probably also disarms you a bit, because you think, oh, okay, these things are happening, but it doesn't feel as bad because I'm seeing it through the lens of what a child would see. But then on the other hand, you think how awful it is as well, because and there are parts where you know, they've grown up and they're looking back and remembering what happened, and so that you know, when they talk about the brutality and the relentless brutality towards people who are in a different caste, they're really and to you know, these kind of constructed laws, which are artificial to the children. They look back and they see how, you know, what they've experienced has affected them for their whole life, you know.
Yeah. And does it paint a picture, like, I mean, my first thought, the fact that they're older does mean that this isn't always the case in the book, obviously, but, like, obviously whenever you hear something like this, the classic of that genre of innocence looking at a deeper issue is obviously, like, I think To Kill a Mockingbird, probably knows.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Good book, yeah. So it sounds like this might occupy that space a little bit, but also since they grow up, obviously you're going to be seeing a deeper picture of it.
Yeah.
Does that mean that these characters are not always good guys, like these central twin figures, or are they always kind of presented as good?
I think the genius of the book is not that it presents them as kind of, you know, good, ethical humans, but just basically presents it from their perspective as children and then from their perspective looking back in terms of, you know, how their innocence was shattered, I suppose, really, over time. And it does that really, really effectively, because they cannot, and I suppose shows that they can't understand why there's this sudden shift towards this aggression and violence. And it's always been there, but they've just been shielded from it. And they've not known that, you know, their friend Valutha was from a different caste and, you know, that they shouldn't be associating with this person, and that there's all these rules that apply. If you are in a different type of human being, you can't do certain things, you know. I mean, these are rules that are, you know, have been clearly established. If we make comparisons to Indigenous people, you know, I mean, land systems really had similar type of effects. This is what I was thinking when I was doing it. I thought, gosh, you know, this whole idea that because Indigenous people didn't form the type of society that we regarded as civilization, they were treated as non-existent, and that justified the application of common law. That justified us taking land because there was no one here, apparently.
Yeah, that's the putting the lawyer look at it, and that's interesting because, like, okay, because I feel like we're very close to going back down that rabbit hole, which I really want quickly, I do want to ask, was that why the book spoke to you when you first read it, or is that a new area that's
interesting? It spoke to me because at the time, because I did my doctorate at Melbourne Uni about 20 years ago, and
millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And so about the time, I think, I'm pretty sure, my timing might be totally out, but it was a while ago that I did my doctorate, and I think it was about the time either I was writing it or had just finished it when I read that book. And it really struck me that there were, you know, just the foolishness, I mean, these kind of adherence to these, I mean, of this way of perceiving fellow human beings, you know, and the inhumanity of it. Right. And I don't know, I suppose that kind of gels with some of the stuff I've been reading in the other book. I know we're focusing on one book, but the overstory.
No, we can talk about the other ones. So are you talking about the overstory now or the
essay? I'm talking about the overstory because what I loved about that was just this kind of sense of these beautiful, gentle friends that we have that are with us. You know, there are he talks about them through different stories, through different experiences that the people in the short stories have, but he talks about them, you know, as being our common ancestors. And I just think that it's such a powerful thing. And I love the fact that Richard Powers is a professor at Stanford University, and apparently, and this might just be something that he said for the book, for the marketing of the book, but he said he was, you know, in a forest of giant sequoia trees, and he suddenly felt inspired to write something about not just our relationship with trees, but the impact that trees have had on us and can have on us.
I guess, and for anyone who, for just a very, very brief summary of the overstory as well, it's basically a loose collection of characters who then kind of come together, and it's all tree related. So trees are almost like the overarching
trees.
It's a very pro tree book.
It's a pro tree book,
but it's also like it does speak to that idea because it's funny. You then mentioned the legal rights thing, and we are jumping around a bit, I guess. But in this essay you mentioned, where like should trees have legal rights? Because obviously, because of you mentioning this podcast coming up, I started reading the overstory because I've heard a lot of people say amazing things about it.
Yeah, I'm glad you have.
And it did win the Pulitzer in 2019. So
yeah,
I mean it's so it's been not that is the only judge of quality, but it's a good sign.
It's a good sign.
And yeah, it mentioned it in there. Also, the idea of giving these non-human, not just animals, human rights, but also trees, because
definitely
the argument he gave was like, oh well, corporations don't talk, but we give them rights, so I guess
that's exactly right. And so and also this kind of notion of why, you know, I mean, we're law, for example, is very focused on human rights. We're increasingly, I suppose, focusing on sentience for animals, you know, and as sentient beings, rights for sentient beings. And so Christopher Stone, back in 1972, wrote this groundbreaking essay, which was really saying, you know, well, why can't trees have rights? Trees are living beings, and they're so incredibly critical to us, but we don't necessarily have to, you know, look at it that way. We could just be guardians and protectors of them in the same way that we would other people that don't necessarily have consciousness, you know. And so it's this kind of whole concept of the connection between rights and conscious-based life, I suppose, and, you know, how maybe we could reconceive the way in which we do it. And that was in 1972, before really there was a lot of discussion about climate change and the importance of trees as carbon sinks and et cetera. And so I think, you know, it was groundbreaking stuff, really. And we're seeing a lot of that happen, you know, a lot of that sort of sense of the importance of trees. I mean, perhaps you heard about the birthing trees that the Indigenous people, I think it was on the road to Ararat, they were wanting to protect, because, you know, on the one hand you had the government saying, oh, we need another lane, we need to expand the highway so people can get to work quicker, and, you know, drive cars, which probably are going to emit tons of greenhouse gas emissions because we don't have electric cars at the moment. And even if we did have electric cars, we don't have electricity that's renewable. Anyway, side point. And so, you know, our imperative is to develop planning laws that allow, you know, reduced travel time. And then there was this gorgeous story of this Indigenous elder that had to protect the grandfather tree, because these were birthing trees that you know, dating back generations, where children had been born and they were protectors of Indigenous communities. And so rather than rely on law, she just basically sat in front of it to stop it being cut down. And so it's a gorgeous story. And, in fact, I think at the start when I was setting up this new course that I've done, I thought I read the overstory and I read that, you know, that, which just such a powerful story. And I thought, right, I'm going to start my first topic. Instead of calling it Introduction to Environmental Law, my first topic is called Trees, George. I just thought, you know what? We could just change the way we look at it. You know, we can look at laws relating to trees. And so when you said to me, you know, do you want to do a podcast? I thought, you know what? That's my vibe at the moment. That's what I've been looking at. And, you know, I think I can connect a lot of what I've been reading to my interest in that at the moment.
Well, it sounds like I'm just going to take a wild stab, because it was in this early stages, obviously, when you were doing your PhD, looking at Indigenous communities, and then you'd read this book, The God of Small Things, which was kind of – it almost seems like – it's weird because I wanted to say the word bigotry, but it's not exactly bigotry, because you're talking about like even groups which almost no one would even consider. You can't be a bigot to trees. Like, so maybe that's the wrong word there.
Yeah.
But it's about looking at things, judging things as lesser or separate or not part of the human condition. And it seems like you've taken that from not just human perspective, but even deeper into because the God of Small Things is almost the most basic version, because it's as simple as, humans looking at other humans in the same group almost, but completely separate. And then you're looking at Indigenous communities.
And how naive are we? Because we don't even see how important interhumans are. Like, you know, how important is it that the children had this wonderful friend to care for them because he played with them every day, you know, and how awful and impactful and damaging it was for them to have had him, you know, aggressively beaten. And then at the same time, how important are trees to us? I mean, of course they are. They're our lifeblood. We can't live without them. We have to value them and we have to, you know, treat them with respect. And if that means, and I suppose really what Christopher Sturm is getting at in 1972, if that means we have to give them rights, kind of set up this kind of construct where they operate, you know, that to protect them, we put them in the paradigm in which we operate, which is rights, entitlements, you know, then that's what we have to do. And we can recalibrate things to make sure that we achieve that.
Mm. So I guess, so I guess this is the part which I'm still trying to, which ties into law in general, really. And even a reflection there of like, so if you do that, then how much does that change versus how much is it going that direction already or whatever? But also just how much law is a reflection of, it's not as, whatever the law might be saying, it's actually always just a reflection of what's happening there on the ground in a sense, if you know what I mean? Yeah. So something like, because I haven't read the book, so I haven't seen how the characters view it themselves, but do they end up actually taking on some of this bigotry themselves? Do they end up thinking that maybe they are better in some ways, or they end up being indoctrinated into that attitude, or whether
that's
the natural state of being?
I think they're highly traumatized, and it sort of atomizes their family. And I think that bigotry, which they weren't entirely aware of because they had a level of freedom, because of course they were a higher caste, you know, meant that they were perhaps not as aware of maybe, and it's interesting, and I'm just sort of stream of consciousness right now, but I'm just sort of thinking maybe because You're more aware of it if you're from the lower caste, aren't you? You're far more aware.
Oh, always. Always.
And so, you know.
That's the that's what privilege is. Because yeah, in where you don't know that you have it.
Right. You don't know you have it. So true. Yeah. So you know, there's the more you think about this book, the more it comes out, I guess, you know, that you think that, of course, they had no idea. They were young, they were privileged, they had freedoms, they had no idea. And so, but they did, looking back. And the trauma of realizing that sort of indoctrination and that bigotry and that discrimination stayed with them their whole lives, and it destroyed their childhood, really.
At least, like, yeah, in terms of, yeah, looking back on it as well. So is that something which did you have to look for just some more connections there? And it also seems to suit with what you've gone into. Was that something you experienced at all? You had any insight into, or were you always like, from in your own life,
yeah,
were you
in
like
my own personal
in a privileged position, or were you kind of seeing that bigotry happening around you somewhere?
No, look, first of all, I'll say this, that I am in a privileged position because I have, you know, I'm well educated, and I have a responsibility to try and, you know, educate other people. You know, that's my public responsibility. Academics, you know, that's what they do. They research and they teach, and that is my responsibility. But my background is definitely not privileged. I went to a state school. I worked really hard. I remember telling my careers advisor that I wanted to do law, and that was probably because I watched some stupid show, you know, what would it have been back then, LA Law or something. I probably had no idea. And he said to me, Samantha, you haven't got a hope in hell of doing law. And you know what, George, maybe it's just my character. That was the motivation that I needed. I thought, right, that's it. I went home and I said to Mum, because I didn't even know that I wanted to do law. I just said it. It was something that I'd probably seen on the television or something. And I said, I'm going to do law. Now I am going to do law. And that I can literally remember thinking, because I, you know, we were extremely working class, you know, I never really thought about academic aspirations. But then I think I started to think, oh, right, you know, I mean, I'm never say that I've been discriminated against, never put myself in that position, but I would say that I do understand the difference between, I suppose, having privileges associated with wealth and not. For me, it was very important to give it a go. And you know what? I was able to do that because of Gough Whitlam, right? He made education free. And so I worked really hard, you know. We didn't have a desk. I had my mum's old sewing machine. We didn't have a computer. Okay. I mean, I'm old. And we you know, I used to handwrite my papers and things. And I really wanted to get into Melbourne Uni, but I was two marks off. And I got into Monash and I thought the world had ended. Monash would kill me for saying that now.
No. That's great.
And then, you know, and then when I went, I can remember, okay, when I went to enroll, one of the administrators said, oh, you know, that's quite a good result from that school. So that was like, and at the time, and everyone was in a group at law school when I went, everyone was in a group from a private school except for me. So there were a couple of outliers, a couple of crazy ones, and that was me and a couple of other girls from Ballarat High, and, you know, we were just, I think, you know, we just were so happy. I was so happy to be there, that worked pretty hard and finished my degree, and then went to work in a law firm and hated it. And it wasn't what I thought it was going to be.
Mm. And especially back a few years ago, that would have been probably, yeah, a lot of reasons why that would be the case.
Oh, yes, George. I can tell you there was, you know, gender issues, and it was just a nightmare. It was actually a really difficult place to work. It's quite toxic. And I'm sure that it's changed a little bit, but it's still not necessarily what law graduates expect. But the change that's happened now, I think, is that there are so many different things you can do now, you know, and back then it was kind of, you know, well, that's your end point. You go off and you work in a firm, or once you've done that after a couple of years, you go to the bar. And so I just remember my professor saying, do you want to come back and do some tutoring? And that was the start of it. You know, I just went back, enrolled in a master's and went from there.
You found the avenue which could still appeal to you whilst not dealing with that kind of environment you mentioned. It's interesting you're saying this because, like, I'll be honest, I have an obsession with, I'm almost a class reductionist in some ways, as that's how I kind of view the world. As in, that's the ultimate basis of, I think most things can boil down to there's still other things involved, but so much of it can boil down to, I think, the class-based analysis more so than almost any other way. Mm-hmm. So when you say your background, and especially heightening it by actually going into these universities where you would be surrounded by private school people who are kind of there, you probably would have felt that in a weird way, and I'm not saying it in a negative way or anything, but like almost with your read of A God of Small Things almost sounds like you're seeing that more because you're coming from that position of that lower caste thing. You're absolutely appreciating that.
Absolutely.
Difference.
No, George, that's right. That's exactly where I'm coming from. And you're right. That is the lens that I put on it, because that's the lens I have, you know, and that's the lens I had. And you know, I suppose done a few more things now. For a long time, I felt like I had to work harder than everybody else because I'm not entirely sure that I deserve to be there, you know. And and I've done a lot of things. One of the things that I loved, and you know, Americans are amazing people, especially American academics. And I was doing some work on coal seam gas in New South Wales, and you know, all of the environmental issues, and the Harvard Environmental Policy Unit asked me to come over and give a presentation over there.
All right. And, at Harvard, not too bad.
Yeah, it wasn't too bad, exactly. I was really happy. And so I asked whether I could go, and it turned out that another professor, a male professor, was going to Harvard to give a presentation as well at a similar time. And they said, oh, well, actually, no, we don't have the budget. We've already authorized, you know, this person to go. And so I contacted Harvard, and that, you know, I feel like sometimes they were like a decade ahead of us, and they said, well, what, who is this person? How come he can go and you can't? And they said, you got to go and ask your dean and make sure that's, you know, that you've got parity there, that there's not discrimination. And I thought, gosh, I hadn't even thought of it that way. You know, I've just been looking at it as a funding thing. And, anyway, then I went back and I said, look, can I go? And they said, look, we need a formal invitation. I said, well, I've got an email invitation. That's pretty good. And they said, no, we need a written invitation. Now, this gives you an idea of what, you know, I mean, I still think there are issues for females in all sorts of ways. And I thought, oh, okay, right, you know. And so I said to the organisers at Harvard, look, they need a written invitation, and they said fine, and then arrived in it was actually, they sent me this on parchment paper, and it was framed.
That's hilarious,
and it was so good. It really inspired me, George, because I thought, you know what, people are interested in some of the things, you know, that I might have to say. And I think that's true for so many people, you know, who feel like perhaps, I don't know, like you say, you reduce a lot to class, and it can make you less, more inhibited perhaps in terms of what you've got to offer. I think it's important to try and sort of change those perspectives a little bit. I think it is changing.
That's kind of the hope, right? I mean, that it's... I guess the first step is knowing you've got a problem, which I think everyone's getting more aware of that as we go.
The first step is knowing you've got a problem, but also, like, you know, for example, I often think with students, when you hear nothing, you know, it's that whole sort of sense of thinking, oh, I've got nothing to say, you know, they won't be interested. But in fact, that's exactly what I'd like to hear. I'd like to hear what students have to think about, more, you know, what their thoughts are. It might be they have no thoughts because they've not read any of the cases or any of the materials. I get that. But there, I'm sure that there's a cohort out there that have and that, you know, just kind of want to express themselves. And I think, you know, you can. It takes a while to perhaps get to that point. But to get back to the book, I think that you're right. I think that the perspective of coming from a less privileged position and perhaps having some innocence associated with that really resonated with me when I went to university. Mm.
And I guess one more thing, like I said, I could go forever with this stuff. I do find it so fascinating. But the fact that the book itself, and this will tie into the other stuff as well, but the fact that it's based on, it's in India, so you're seeing that other culture. So it's probably like giving that extra layer. Was other cultures, including the indigenous culture here, which shouldn't be other, but it is because of how Australia works.
Yeah.
Was that something that always interested you as well? Or was that a late thing just because of another example of bigotry? Or yeah, how did that kind of come
about? That's such a good question. I'm so glad you asked that question. And yeah, absolutely. It's always interested me, you know. I mean, the use of the word other, I agree with you, you know, difference, you know. And I suppose because it's not, I haven't been different, but I feel like I've generally been an outlier. It's true. and that's because, let's face it, you were talking about everything being reduced by class. I mean, a lot of Australian society is defined that way. And so I haven't necessarily fitted the mold. And so I haven't really been bothered with all of that, right? I just think, oh, whatever. And then what intrigues me, definitely different cultures and different ways of looking at things and different ideas, you know. And I absolutely love a lot of the stories and depictions from, you know, Indigenous culture. It's just fascinating. But also Indian culture, amazing, so multi-layered. The food, I love Indian food. But also, you know, I think there's a little bit of that comes through the book, you know, that all those textures of you know, different ways of living. It's just the way in which the day, you know, you've got afternoon naps and different temperatures and, you know, different things that you do.
I'm Greek. I'm a big believer in an afternoon nap. Don't get me started.
Yeah. That's right. I wish. I probably do have an afternoon nap sometimes in some of my classes. I'm into that now.
And you're the one teaching. It's impressive. I think it's interesting. You don't fall to the trap of obviously Orientalism or anything like that, but because of the Asian cultures, especially, they're just more different to Western society. So when you look at something like India, it's very different and it's very rich in its difference. It's got a very long history of difference, which
it really
applies
has.
To almost everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. It's beautiful country and beautiful people and very rich in its history and you know, fascinating, really, because, you know, in many ways you can sort of say, oh, well, you know, it's a bit – often your lived experience you think is a bit boring because you're living it. So you kind of want – it's very interesting to look at difference and to try and sort of see where it evolved from. And you were talking about being fascinated by history because, you know, it's informed so much by historical civilizations and events that have happened and reactions to those events and so on. Mm.
And how much that reflects. So I guess bring it circle again. So to that initial point, and this is where like I can almost be cynical in some ways, but also maybe it's impossible to say where, like, what's natural for humans and what's not natural for humans because of how moldable we are depending on the culture we're in. But how much of, like, even the laws you look at and these issues you see there with this caste system, how much that seems to be a tribal basic attitude of the human condition. So in some ways it's not artificial because it is playing to some of our more base instincts, if you know what I mean.
I do. That's exactly what I think about that book. I think that it is playing on our base instincts. It is very tribal. And, you know, it's this kind of whole concept of I'm better than you. You know, do we want to say that? Or even, maybe even better isn't the right word. I'm I'm different to you, and you know, maybe value. I have you know, superior value or something like that. That there's a lot of that going on, and it you know, it's completely infiltrates our history. So colonialism and imperialism, of course, is steeped in all of that. You know, that British ways of doing things are the superior way of doing things, and therefore British people are superior people. And I think, and colonists, therefore, you know, we come over from the motherland, and we need to follow what the motherland has always been doing because that's the way things are done. And now we see. I was talking to a conservationist and ecologist on the weekend, and she was saying that we're changing the way in which we deal with bushfires because we've always thought that bushfire management was just about doing burn-offs. But Indigenous people used to do what's called mosaic burn-offs, where they burn little tiny areas. We didn't want to do that because we had private property and private owners didn't want little areas of their property being burned. Mm. But in fact, burning that undergrowth is critical to stop these enormous fires and also to ensure that animals that are being burned in these horrific bushfires have little places to go, because it sort of creates these little
pockets.
Yeah, little pockets where they can hide. And so we're only now learning that. So 2021, and the fallout from the 2019 catastrophic fires, we're thinking, oh, maybe we should take on board some of the Indigenous practices, you know. And I think that kind of concept of looking outside of ourselves is incredibly important for our future welfare.
And I guess like the other side with that, yeah, because even you mentioned actually a few things, because firstly, this is some ominous foreshadowing for potentially, based on what the news is saying of the fires that are happening in the Northern Hemisphere, I'm very concerned about what's coming this summer. Come tune in this summer for horrific more bushfires.
Yeah.
Before that, you mentioned the act of looking at someone as less, and that how that's ingrained in it's a base instinct, I guess.
Yeah.
But I also look at almost, and again, to tie it into property law, I guess, it's almost like protecting ourselves. So we build up these fences where you're outside of it and we're inside of it because we're protecting ourselves, which ties in very much with – that's the root of a lot of – I feel like bigotry is bad, and I'm not trying to justify it at all in that sense, but I do understand it in terms of like where it comes from, because it's almost like we start off just protecting ourselves, and then slowly over time we feel bad, or maybe we're protecting ourselves from these groups and we're – our family or whatever, our children, then that slowly peters out into us like making it natural law, making us feel better about ourselves by having done this first step. I don't know, that's kind
and
of
that,
how
no, that's
how,
right. I mean, it's sort of this kind of Darwinian perspective that, you know, I suppose that you've got this biological instinct to look after yourself, and, you know, whoever's the toughest will survive. But in actual fact, I mean, that first of all, I don't necessarily think that's what that is Darwinian. I think that it's far more nuanced and evolved than that. And secondly, to survive, we have to work together. So we have to kind of start thinking about, you know, looking at different ways of doing things and seeing how they could improve what we're doing now. But that's not necessarily intuitive, because we have constructed these, and we do kind of go back to these kind of base principles of thinking, oh, well, you know, the way I do things is the best way, you know, that I know what I'm doing, I understand. So a gas-led recovery is the best way to deal with COVID. We know what we're doing. We really don't need advice from anyone else. And yet, of course, the implications of that are profound for everybody. No one wants to get beyond 2 degrees. Horror. So why not open up the debate and work out, you know, what's the best way moving forward? Because really it's just about how can we create energy and, you know, reduce emissions and reduce environmental. I mean, I say as if it's simple, but it's policy should be more informed by, I think, you know, more a broader range of groups. It's very insular, and maybe that reflects our tribal perspectives.
It's power. Who holds the power? They'll make everything defined how they want it to.
Power too. Yeah. Really. But I mean, I think to come back to the book, I think that it does really reflect, you know, if we're really honest with ourselves, that we do often feel that way. And it's something, is it learnt behavior? You know, and I think that's what she's getting at, you know. These girls were able to run free. They weren't constrained and taught not to talk to the lower caste. And then they had this trauma when the system kind of caught up with them. You know, and so I suppose, can we ever really get away from it?
Mm. And then, yeah, and how it puts a positive we can, as long as things advance, I guess, in a sense, as long as we don't slide
backwards. Well, I know.
Education, that's it. If everyone's educated, then you can't help
it. And, I mean, it's playing out with COVID too, of course, because, you know, you've got all these people that are vaccinated and unvaccinated, and the ones that believe it's all a big myth and the ones that don't, and, like, all of the different groups with all of their firm perspectives on what's right. You know, there's a bit of tribalism in all of that as well.
Oh, yeah. 100%, and obviously the new media landscape is designed specifically to heighten that tribalism rather than to lessen it.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Literally, that's its purpose.
Yeah.
Okay, well, look, we've jumped around a lot, but I think we've got a nice – I should call it off there before we go on forever. Right. So thank you very much for being on the show. That was really fun. Is there any – this usually I have performers on who I might say this, but is there anywhere anyone can reach or look into your stuff or your work?
Sure. I've got – you know, you can just go to Deakin Law School and look me up. And I don't really – I'm not really a big – performer on social media, but I've done quite a lot of papers on The Conversation if you're interested in the sort of work that I do.
Oh, that is good, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I'll put a link to maybe some of that in the description anyway. But yes, thank you very much again, Samantha Absolutely. Hepburn. Thank you for being on.
Loved it. Thank you very much, George.
Cheers.
Okay, bye.
Thanks for listening. If you want to help support this show and all the other shows we do here at Sans Pants Radio, then why not subscribe to SansPantsPlus.com? For as little as $5 a month, you could have access to a whole bunch of bonus shows and content. Once again, that's SansPantsPlus.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.